You don't need a study to tell you that aging and fatigue go hand in hand. Nevertheless, my friends at Nutritional Therapeutics, makers of NT Factor, point to 16 studies, all peer-reviewed and published in medical journals, showing that NT Factor can reduce fatigue, while at the same time, age-related changes in the cells are reversed. For 30 years, the makers of NT Factor have worked to improve our health spans by focusing on the mitochondria, the energy powerhouses of our cells. Their science shows that NT Factor, which I don't go a day without and recommend to my patients, improves our energy and prevents the deterioration that accompanies aging. They promise us that our day-to-day lives will be improved, and they keep proving it in studies that include placebo-controlled trials, both in the academic institutions and in medical practices like mine. You can find NT Factor at your favorite health food store or online retailer, or to order direct, go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Don't let tiredness and fatigue rob your senior years. Invest regularly in the anti-aging benefit of NT Factor at ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly opportunity to answer your questions. Every week I get together with Layla Mutin, who's our resident nutritionist, and we endeavor to field your questions and address your comments. Place to go is questions@drhoffman.net.
Yes.
With me today is Layla Mutin, who is our resident nutritionist, and happy Women's Month. Remember I did a tribute to you.
Oh.
As part of women's, you know, like we did a thing like Women Pioneers in Nutrition.
Oh, right. I remember.
And we started with people in, you know, in these sort of starched collars, you know, and black dresses.
Yes.
They look like Civil War widows.
Yeah.
And they were like pioneers in early nutrition in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And then we kind of traced it forward to the 20th century.
Yeah.
And I think you are our one of our few surviving pioneers. The rest are
dead. Post-home economics.
You don't have to, right. You don't have to be dead to be a pioneer.
Oh,
you
my know, gosh.
There's some people who like invented like some sort of
yeah.
home nutrition program for
yeah.
for the you know, the sickly and people mm-hmm. who traditionally, since cooking is kind of a female thing, there
yeah.
is a predominance
yeah.
of female nutritionists. When I go to my American Nutrition Association conferences, I'm surrounded by
yeah.
women. You know,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like a 10-to-1 ratio.
Yeah. yeah. Men are creeping in a
yeah.
little more,
yeah.
which is terrific.
Yeah.
So, but yeah.
Yeah.
Here we are.
So, happy Women's Month. And
when is Men's Month?
When do we
celebrate men?
It's Nutrition Month. No, men are...
Oh, March is National Nutrition Month. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Men,
yeah.
men need to pay reparations.
Oh,
that's
oh,
what,
I see.
Well, we don't get any.
I disagree with that.
No special status.
But that's not fair, you see. I want it to be equitable.
Okay.
For all of us.
Okay.
Anyway. So March is National Nutrition Month.
And, okay, so the yeah. intersection of female and Women's Month and Nutrition Month.
Yeah.
And I ran that feature. Maybe I'll run it again.
Yeah.
You know? Okay.
Yeah.
So, here we be. And we'll answer questions momentarily. Questions come to questions@drhoffman.net.
Mm-hmm.
And recently I had the opportunity to interview someone familiar to you, who is Gary Taubes.
Yeah.
And for our listeners who are not familiar with Gary Taubes, T-A-U-B-E-S, the E-S is not pronounced, there was an article back in 2002. I think you might remember it. If you'd got your New York Times and you've got your New York Times Magazine, and there was a big picture of like this greasy steak.
I think I still have that issue.
It was like a visual image of a juicy, fatty steak on a platter
with butter on it.
Yeah, and it said, "What if it was one big fat lie?"
Yes.
Pun intended.
Yeah.
And what he basically was saying, and in kind of a landmark article, was, let's turn this paradigm on its head.
Yeah.
Now, you participated in the paradigm shift because you were with Dr. Atkins.
Yes. And The timing of this couldn't be more appropriate, because that fall I was entering the nutrition department into the nutrition program at Hunter College as an undergraduate. Uh-huh. So I was jumping up and down in my living room saying, "See?
Yeah.
See?"
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
So I got to go learn a lot of the miseducation that they teach.
Yeah.
Even today in nutrition courses and all of that, and temper it to, you know, that information and my experience with Dr. Atkins and his staff there, which was gold in terms of education and stuff like that.
Did you treat a lot of diabetics there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Both type 1 and type 2 diabetics?
More type 2, more overweight obese.
Right, right. So, okay, so yeah. So Gary has written a book entitled Rethinking Diabetes. Mm-hmm. And it's a very thoughtful book. It's actually a very voluminous history of the way that we had traditionally treated obesity and diabetes until the advent of insulin. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting is that it was well understood prior to the invention or discovery of insulin in 1921 and the first application to patients in the early 20s. That the way to address diabetes and obesity was through a very low carb diet.
Yeah.
And to have people eat meat, and have lots of cream.
Yep.
And butter.
Mm-hmm.
But to the exclusion of carbohydrates.
Yeah.
And in fact, I recall, because this is, it was discovered in 1921. I think in 1921, the New York Historical Society had a centennial of the discovery of insulin.
Yeah.
And it was pioneered at the Joslin Clinic. Joslin was one of the prime movers in doing
preeminent
this.
Preeminent in diabetes centers, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And what they had was these artifacts, which were diaries of especially young children and adolescents who had type 1 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And they recorded every morsel that they ate. And it was, you would look at these diaries and it'd be like, you know, butter and whole cream,
mm-hmm.
and meat,
mm-hmm.
and, bacon. And, mm-hmm. but they would endeavor not to have any carbohydrates. And that's how they survived. Now without insulin, type 1 diabetics still succumb to complications early in life, but it prolonged their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is a carbohydrate disease.
Yes.
It's a disease of inability to handle carbohydrates. So what he said was that they kind of took a wrong turn when they discovered insulin, because the priority became, all right, we'll give the insulin, and oh, by the way, insulin enables you to eat a quote normal diet.
Right.
And you don't have to worry so much about what you eat, and it's like a pain in the ass to do that.
Just take insulin.
We'll give you insulin. And the problem was that the result of giving insulin without any dietary accompaniment was that people would have to cover their food with insulin. In other words, you're allotted so many carbohydrates, but you have to take more insulin to metabolize the carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
And the net effect of that is to drive fat storage and to promote premature cardiovascular disease and perhaps hasten other complications like kidney disease.
Yes.
Because most of the people who are now in dialysis are diabetics.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many hundreds of thousands of people who rely on dialysis. And high percentage of the people get heart attacks and strokes and diabetics.
There are more dialysis centers around, I've noticed.
Yeah, well, I'm planning to do an interview that's kind of an expose on the dialysis industry, which could be kind of an interesting topic for Intelligent Medicine. I'm lining that up now, so stay tuned.
Wow.
But anyway, so now what he also, so he says it's based on a misunderstanding, because we know that people who are on a very low carb diet, we call that a ketogenic diet.
Mm-hmm.
So they put ketones in their urine, and you remember that Atkins would recommend people get those purple keto sticks.
Right.
They turn purple
when you're in ketosis.
When you're effectively becoming a fat burning machine.
Yes.
and subsisting on fat metabolism instead of glucose metabolism, which is great for weight loss and a variety of things. It's even maybe great for mental acuity.
Absolutely.
For psychiatric problems. They're now testing it out in psychiatric disorders. There was even a study of a keto diet for alcoholism.
Oh, it's a new thing.
So
that's interesting.
But they confuse that with what's called ketoacidosis, which is like an out-of-control diabetes thing.
Right.
And in the minds of a lot of doctors, it's dangerous to be a diabetic and have a ketosis.
Yes, you know? They confuse ketoacidosis with ketosis.
Right.
They are two completely different things.
Yeah. But, so ketosis is physiologic. It's what the body kicks into when we're either fasting or whether there's a lack of carbohydrates.
Which
is in certain seasons.
Kind of makes sense.
In human evolution, the only food that was available was animal food.
Right.
Because it was cold and there weren't any crops.
Right.
And unless you stored some things, you know, maybe you, you know,
you found a blueberry under the glacier. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's not likely, but you know.
Right.
This was like humans' adaptation to low carb is to switch from a glucose metabolism to a keto metabolism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's actually written a book on the case for keto. It's called The Case for Keto, which is an interesting book on, you know, talking about that. And, so in this book, he also talks about the tremendous resistance that there's been from the American Diabetes Association, Heart Association, that even to this day, with evidence that low-carb diets are really beneficial for both type 1 and type 2 diabetics, that they still are stuck in that paradigm. And why that is because there is still this belief that if you eat dietary fat, it's going to deposit in your arteries. And they know that diabetics have heart disease, so they said, don't eat a high-fat diet.
I think it's a little more nefarious.
Even more nefarious. Well,
there's big agriculture and big food.
No
and they
question.
Need to get all of that going. Yeah. And how else are they going to keep all that going unless they make saturated fat the enemy? And we're still dispelling this myth day in and day out with patients.
It's
and
very
with
tenacious.
Patients. It really, really
very
is.
Very tenacious. Right? So anyway, you know, he personally, anecdotally said that, you know, when he got on a low-carb diet, he just lost 35 pounds.
Bang.
And he didn't disclose whether he was diabetic, but he probably had metabolic syndrome.
Sure. And most people do.
Yeah.
Walking around.
So what he did give kudos to, and this is kind of interesting too, he's a guy named Dr. Richard Bernstein, who is like the guru of...
Is it Richard or David?
It's Richard, I think.
Okay. All right.
I think it's Richard.
I thought it was David.
I think
anyway.
It's definitely...
It's a Dr. Bernstein.
I know, it's Dick
who's
Bernstein.
Who's also...
Because I went to medical school
with
him.
Oh, you did. Yeah. So Dick Bernstein would be Richard.
Yeah.
And he himself was a type 1 diabetic.
And he told the story of Bernstein, who was the oldest medical student at Einstein. He was 40 when he started medical school, which is really unusual. I was older. I was 26 when I started, but he was like quite old.
Yeah.
He's still alive, which means he's well into his 80s, pushing 90 by now. And that's very unusual for a type 1 diabetic. He's an insulin dependent diabetic.
He's taking good care of it.
Now, the story is he originally pioneered in engineering, and he saw when he was a diabetic that in the doctor's office they had these ways of using finger sticks to determine your glucose. And he said, well, wouldn't it be great to create a consumer-friendly thing, which would be the blood glucose monitor? So he developed this as an engineer, made his money, and then decided that he wanted to, you know, he definitely was well off from that.
Did he create the blood glucose?
Whether he created it or whether he perfected it for consumer use, I don't know.
Wow.
But he then decided to go to medical school, which is kind of, you know, pretty daunting at the age of 40 when you're a diabetic.
Mm.
And I also remember him sitting always in the front row, you know, like a really eager student. I was always like kind of tucked away in the back, you know, like, you know, like the back right-hand side of the lecture hall. Near the door because it was too boring. I would just kind of like, you know.
Just kind of wander out.
Yeah, wander out. He was eager beaver up in the front row, but he was always ostentatiously checking his blood sugar because he had his device that was of his own creation. And he also believed in small doses of insulin, smaller the better, taken frequently. And the tendency then was to give people really high doses of insulin that were long lasting. And the problem was, you know, you were very prone to hypoglycemia.
Yes, and insulin shock, and you have to really monitor what you eat.
So anyway, so
and when
and we were in a nutrition study group together. Mm-hmm. And true story, we were debating one another because I at the time was a vegan macrobiotic adherent.
Yeah.
And he was like all into this, like, you're eating fat and you're eating meat, like you're going to die.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to say that history and science has vindicated his viewpoint. Mm-hmm. And he's helped innumerable patients, and he sort of created a template for, you know, look, this requires a very dedicated patient because you have to monitor your blood sugar really carefully and you have to eat really carefully.
Yes.
And it's not for everyone. Just wanted to take, give me the insulin, you know.
Right, right.
But you can minimize your dose of insulin. The less insulin, the less metabolic syndrome.
Yes.
And, you know, and that's what is the interesting thing about type 2 diabetics. They have too much insulin.
Yeah.
And that too much insulin drives high blood pressure, and it drives even potentially cancer. You know, it has a lot of downsides.
Dyslipidemia, so, yeah. All of that.
I asked him what he thought of the new, you know, there's a whole new thing, which is a new paradigm for diabetes, which is the semaglutides and combo meds. And what he said was interesting. He said, you know, he wasn't against them, but he said the question is whether they'll be sustainable. You know, because for many people, they're not cost-sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And also whether it's sustainable for people to put up with the side effects. And then, you know, when you can't afford it or you can't stand the side effects anymore, will you regain all the weight? Will you lose your lean muscle mass? You know, these are some things that are of concern. But they do offer a plausible off-ramp, an alternative for type 2 diabetics.
Okay, yeah.
So, it was really good conversation, and I recommend that you go to drhoffman.com and
I can't wait
check
to listen
out the podcast.
To that. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I know that it's to listen to me talk is kind of a busman's holiday for you, frankly. But there are a few
guests.
Yeah, but there are a few select guests, you know, because if I have a guest who's talking about the evils of sugar, it's like, I'm there already. Hello.
So I don't
need to listen to that. But, you know, when I get like a guest like Gary Taubes, you may want to listen while you're, you know, in the car. Or I listen when I'm vacuuming the apartment, you know, or I sometimes will get on the stationary bicycle and listen for an hour to a podcast. Mm-hmm. Not my own podcast, you know, somebody else. Because need to listen to myself.
Yeah. I'll download the podcast while I'm cleaning or dusting or something.
Yeah.
So it's just on. Yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah.
All right. So, and speaking of which, I did something new that they have, it's sort of reprised. A while ago, we recorded something called Taming Your Addiction to Food and Defensive Eating. And that was actually a good thing that we put together. And they're actually
That was a few years ago.
Yeah. Well, it's back at drhoffman.com/defensive eating. DearHoffman.com/defensive eating. And it's a seminar that I did with you, which will arm you with proven strategies you can put to use immediately so you can effectively change your eating behaviors. Because there is to look at overweight as from an addiction model, I think is a good way to look at it. Now, you can't abstain from eating.
No.
You can abstain from alcohol. You can abstain from drugs.
Yeah.
But you can't abstain from eating. So it's kind of a, you got to take a different approach. And I think we kind of nailed it in that. That's one of our classic lectures. So we're making it available at drhoffman.com.
Yes, go check it out.
Defensive eating.
All right.
So go ahead.
There's something you wanted to touch on, Dr. Hoffman, about a slight correction that we need to make here.
Yeah.
About transcatheter mitral valve replacement, which is TMVR.
Right.
And I think last week when we were talking about, somebody had a question about magnesium and what to take. And then, of course, we maybe digressed a little bit and we started talking about various conditions that would require certain types of magnesium. Mitral valve prolapse was one of those conditions we talked about. And I think maybe you said something like TAVRs or something.
I said
TMVR.
I said offhandedly, like, well, mitral valve prolapse is generally a benign condition, but sometimes it can progress to the problem where the valve is not competent and you have to have surgery. But I said surgery these days is not such a big deal because they have ways of not cracking open your chest, and they can do it with a transcatheter measure, mm-hmm. which means that they can introduce the catheter via your wrist or via your groin and thread it up there and just fix your valve.
It's just now, amazing what they do.
Now, that's been very well established for TAVRs, which is trans-aortic mm-hmm. valve replacement. Mm-hmm. The aortic valve sits above the mitral valve.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of the last place where the blood pumps out after it gets squeezed by mm-hmm. The ventricle. So the with TAVRs, it's mm-hmm. well established. And in fact, Mick Jagger had that procedure.
Yeah.
With the mitral valve, it's not been as well established. It's a little harder to perform technically.
Oh.
So there's only been mm-hmm. relatively fewer mitral valve surgeries done with this catheter mm-hmm. thing. However, the progress is being made, and you know, in a few years, I think they'll also have comparability and the potential to do it non-invasively or less invasively
wow.
than they do it now. So okay. I just wanted to make that clarification because I kind of tossed it off as like, yeah, no, you know, piece of cake. It's not, it is actually still under development, mm-hmm. this way
so
of doing
it. So it's not a piece of cake yet.
Well, it's,
it, but it likely,
it can be. And but the reason that it should be done less invasively is that usually by the time that your valve wears out, you could be in your 80s or 90s.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't make sense to be a big, very invasive surgery on someone who's fragile. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it behooves them to develop these less invasive ways.
Yeah.
So that it can be done on older or frailer patients. And they'll get there.
They'll get there.
But it's being pioneered now. So yeah. I just want to say that, you know, mm-hmm. for clarification. And I don't know, none of our listeners like pounced on me for saying it, but I want to, if I...
It was keeping you up at night. You wanted to talk about it again.
Yeah, I just want to clarify it. You know, I looked it up and I did some research on it and I said, you know, I tossed that off rather casually. Mm. So I thought, yeah.
Okay. All right. So we've got an email here from Jean. About hops.
Hops.
So what do you think we're going to talk about now? I saw the link below that she sent us while reviewing the supplements I normally take. I came upon this a few weeks ago, and after hearing you mention hops in your Q&A, I thought I'd send it to you. And these are the hops from the U.S. No need to go to New Zealand, which is what the CaloCurb
right.
supplement,
mm-hmm.
that GLP-1 supplement.
Right. So let me just back mm-hmm. up a little bit. We talked in my newsletter last week mm-hmm. about natural
Ozempic,
you know, which is, you know, mm-hmm. kind of, again, that's, look, there's nothing that's precisely equivalent, but the mode of action is that it may change the microbiome.
Yes.
But it also has the ability to put a bitter break on eating. Mm. And the reason is that you have taste buds in your mouth, but you also have taste buds in your intestine, but they're not like sensory taste buds where you can kind of go, oh, I can taste this in my small intestine, that these taste buds will signal you to satiety.
Mm.
Bitter foods do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, eat a lot of bitter foods, you'll eat less. But hops has particularly that property to put a, quote, bitter break on eating.
Wow.
And that's the mm-hmm. basis of the CaloCurb story. Now, right. I don't know if they got some special kind of hops in New Zealand. I do not know that. All I know is they have the IP, the intellectual property, on studies that show mm-hmm. the potential to affect appetite.
Yeah.
And yeah. weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's something. And that's the whole rationale behind these particular supplements.
I would not, however, recommend that you drink beer to lose weight.
Right, right. But there's another hop supplement called Ostera,
yes.
which is supposed to be good for bone mineral density.
Yeah, well, hops are very interesting. And they, you know, this is actually a big project of Jeffrey Bland.
Uh-huh.
He was a big, there's this thing called xanthothumol or something.
Yes. That's what this is. The Zambu.
Okay. Yeah. And it's got some very interesting properties. It may have a bone strengthening capability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which believe may have the value of addressing
anti-inflammatory.
Yeah. Obesity, metabolic syndrome. So the Zambu.
Change the microbiome potentially, mm-hmm. you know.
Yes. Right? Yeah. So it could be helpful in this way. So because it's feeding the microbiome, and now that's always a place where we're looking to impact when it comes to anything that we're addressing.
What's the New Zealand? It's called Calocurb?
Calocurb.
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 Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll see how, you know,
yeah, I'm not endorsing it. I don't think we've field tested it enough, but it's, you know, we learned about it, and that may be something that we might suggest to some patients to give it a shot to see if they, you know.
Yeah. And enough people I know who have been offered Ozempic are afraid to take it. Ozempic or what's the other one? Mounjaro.
Yeah.
That they're afraid to take it because of the side effects. The rare side effects.
They've taken it and they had experienced side effects?
No, no. They're afraid to start taking
it.
Okay,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, even when it's offered as a therapy. So,
right.
Which I don't blame them, but here we are. Right? But people are lining up around the block for Ozempic.
Yeah.
And that's what's...
It's an interesting thing. There's a company called Ro, which... It was originally called Roman,
mm-hmm.
and it was targeted towards men, and it was a place where you could go online and you could get a prescription for either minoxidil for hair loss, or Viagra, Viagra.
Right. His and hers.
Right. Ro.
Okay.
It's now called Ro, but they used to call it Roman, mm-hmm. which is kind of like a masculine name, so they kind of shortened it to Ro.
Yeah.
They were prescribing testosterone also, but that's going to be curtailed by the government. The government's not going to be so anxious to have these online dispensers of testosterone because it's a scheduled substance. It's a regulated substance. So they, I think, are going to crack down on that. Ro got ahead of that and they said, we'll change the name and we'll make more money prescribing weight loss drugs than, you know, since to fill the gap where testosterone is no longer so readily available.
Yeah.
And we can't make that much money on, you know, minoxidil for hair loss, and we can't make that much money on Viagra because there's a lot of places where you can get it. So
they
changed their strategy.
Okay. All right. Well, we've got a nice little note here from Nicole. Nicole says, I was listening to your podcast on microplastics, and I wanted to give you a product recommendation. For the past few years, I've been packing my family's lunch in the Planet Box lunch boxes. It's called Planet Box.
Mm-hmm.
All of the items are stainless steel, long-lasting, and easily washed in the bottom rack of the dishwasher.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, see, so that's another thing is I never put plastic in the dishwasher because it's just going to, especially
dioxin.
With the heat. It's going to release a lot of the microparticles, and it's going to also release the chemicals and impregnate all the other dishes with the bad stuff.
Yeah.
So I never do that. I use a plastic water bottle that is so-called safe plastic, but I'm not sure it is. For
it's not. I'll
riding.
Tell you why.
Yeah.
Does it say BPA free?
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Joe Pizzerno will say, it doesn't matter that they took out the bisphenol A, they replaced it with a different kind of bisphenol, which can be just as bad.
I know.
So,
here we are. I think there are stainless steel bottles that you can use for your bicycle.
Mm.
I just can't get my head around using a piece of stainless steel on my... It's heavy, I think.
It is. Well, it's not as heavy as glass.
Yeah, that's true. And
that wouldn't
definitely
be a great
do not
idea.
Want to have a glass bottle on my bicycle.
No.
It's not safe. Mm-mm. But I think that's a good, whether it's that brand or I think there are other brands, I think that's a really good alternative. So, for example, I use a SodaStream, and SodaStreams come two ways. One, you get the plastic bottles, and one, you get the glass bottles.
Right.
And most of SodaStreams are with plastic.
Yeah.
With the glass, you can actually get higher pressure, more bubbles, and it's glass.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a little notice on the bottom of the plastic bottles where they actually have an expiration date on the bottle.
Oh, great.
And never use in hot water.
Oh.
It says so, all of that on the bottle.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So, no, I think that's a great suggestion.
Mm-hmm. So, for all of you using plastic bottles over and over and over and over, we probably shouldn't be doing that.
And we used to have thermoses that were glass lined.
Yeah.
You know, thermoses, I think, are generally safe.
Mm-hmm.
Although some of them, I do recall being kind of smelly with like a plastic smell, but maybe that's
true too.
Yeah.
And you got to make sure you clean it properly. There's a lot of nook cranny around the cap and everything that you want to make sure that you're cleaning properly as well. So, yeah. Yeah.
And there's an added benefit because if they're stainless steel, these lunchboxes are bulletproof. So that you can be sure that your child arrives safely at school with a intact lunch
right.
as they dodge the sniper fire in an urban environment.
Oh, right? My goodness.
Not really sniper fire. It's just the gang who couldn't shoot straight, you know.
Right.
With collateral damage.
Yeah. Lunchboxes were such a fun thing to have. You know,
gosh. Cartoon characters
and a little thermos inside,
Roy Rogers,
and
little compartments for like
right.
And then it'd be like, I'll trade you this for the pizza.
Right, you know? right. I don't want this sandwich. You want my sandwich?
You have a Hostess Twinkie.
I'll trade you that for my ding dong or my yodel.
Yeah,
yodel was a thing for me. Wow. Okay. Yeah,
we still turned out. All right, so. That's all the time we have for part one. As our listeners know, we divide our podcast into two parts. And Layla, give us a preview of what we're going to discuss in part two, please.
What do you think of continuous blood pressure monitors?
It depends, and we'll discuss that in detail in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman today with Layla Mutin. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. Just a reminder that, you know, we talk supplements. You can shop hundreds of curated, vetted supplements in my full script dispensary. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com. Lots of reports these days. The latest report is of creatine gummies. Creatine I take. I take it as a powder. I put it into my shake because I think it's good for muscles and brain.
Mm-hmm.
And there are actually neurological benefits to it. So the folks at Now Vitamins have been kind of like looking at what's out there as a service to the industry, and they assayed some gummies that were creatine gummies. Mm. There weren't no creatine in those gummies. They obtained these from Amazon, you know, like just one of the vendors on Amazon.
Oh, no.
And they were like sugary gummies with nothing in them.
With nothing in them.
Yeah. So
there you go.
Got to be careful. Fullscript is reliable and delivery and great service. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com for your supplement needs. All right. When we return, more of your questions. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, and this is Intelligent Medicine.